Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
When my next guest discovered a web of corruption in the French nuclear energy sector, she was subjected to a brutal physical and sexual assault in her home, which she feared would lead to her death. Weeks later, she was charged with fabricating her own assault and would wait another 6 years before her name was cleared. Now the story of this courageous Irish whistleblower has been adapted for the big screen into a French movie entitled La Syndicaliste, or The Trade Unionist. Maureen Kearney, bonjour et bienvenue. You're in France this morning.
Hi, thank you for having me on the programme, Matt.
It's wonderful to speak to you, and it's amazing to see your life story depicted by no less than Isabelle Huppert in the movie. The film has just hit our cinemas, but before we get to your story, Maureen, tell us, how does a woman from Castlebar end up in France and in the position that you came to?
Well, I went to university in the south of France in the 70s for a few years, and I did teacher training. And so I went back to Ireland then for a few years. And when I was back in France once, I met my husband in the middle of the 80s. And I came back to live in France. And what happened? I got pregnant on my daughter. I was working as a press agent for a record company. And I said at that stage, I was working nights, weekends and so on. I can't continue this sort of life with a small baby. So I trained for another year for teaching adults in France. And I immediately was taken on by the what would become AREVA, which was the nuclear engineering sector of the nuclear industry in France. So.
Yeah, and a major,
so that's how I am here.
A major company, AREVA, in France. How did you end up going from kind of the music and theatre world to becoming a prominent trade unionist in France?
Well, about four or five, the end of the 90s, I'd been working in AREVA since the end of the 80s. And towards the end of the 90s, I remember properly, I had students who started breaking down in class, and I started asking them questions, what was going on, and they told me they were being laid off, that they were kind of put into this corridor where everybody who was laid off was sent, and I found that humanly unacceptable. So I started reading up and saying, you know, this is not possible that people can be treated this way. And I came across the whole trade union movement in France. So I went along to see some of the trade unions and saying, what are you doing for people? Because, you know, this is unacceptable. And the CFDT, which is my trade union, said to me at the time, well, instead of kind of insulting us and condemning us, why don't you join us? So I did.
Yeah, and it's extraordinary because the way you were depicted in the movie, it's not like your traditional trade unionist in dungarees or slacks.
No.
Isabelle Huppert captures your sense of style really, really well. But in the movie, Maureen, you are depicted as a pretty tough cookie in what is a notoriously political trade union movement in France. You know, you have this political noose.
Yeah.
You're able to call up the president of France, government ministers, and you are able to get meetings straight away. Was that the case, and how did that come about that you rose to such prominence?
My mom and my grandmother always wrote to politicians about different things. So when I was elected General Secretary of the European Works Council, there were about 12, 14 countries present. And I said, why don't we start writing to politicians and try and get some support from them for different projects that we were working on in the nuclear industry. And so we just kept writing and writing, and then I started getting answers. And then we went to see politicians quite a lot, and it just became part of the routine.
Yeah,
it wasn't done in France as such.
And Yeah, because it's hard, Maureen, for people at home not to, the power of workers' councils in on continental Europe, you know, and the role that they play. So to have risen to the top of that works' council was phenomenal for you personally. But let's go back to the attack and its aftermath. You get wind of a secret deal between France and China to build nuclear reactors. You realise that it will lead to major job losses in your own company. And you decide to make this fact very public. What mm-hmm. happened once you made that decision?
Well, it was in a two-part thing. There was a first contract that came out in November 2011. And I went to see various politicians with the agreement, with the contract. They were absolutely flabbergasted. And wrote to the Prime Minister at the time, who was François Fillon, who knew nothing about it, and he stopped the whole thing. That was in about January 2012. The Socialists were elected into government in May 2012. And one of the people I used to see very often that I had gotten quite close to became a minister in François Hollande's government. And he called me up fairly quickly and said he needed to see me urgently. So I actually never went to see a politician on my own. I always brought somebody with me. So I brought the head of our union on a national level with me to see the minister. And he told us there was another contract out there and that it wasn't very positive for the future of Areva and so on. So I had quite a large network in Paris. I was lucky that way. And I started ringing up and finding out if people knew about this. And I eventually got a copy of the contract. And that's when I started putting it out.
And once...
sending it to me. And
that
on.
Is a real pivot, isn't it, Maureen, in your life? Because once you get a copy of that contract and once you go public, a campaign of intimidation begins that is low level at first. Can you talk us through how that intensified up to, you know, your perseverance and how you weren't getting scared off until you were?
Until I was, I was stressed out totally about the whole thing, because our CEO kept denying there was a contract. And so I had a copy of the contract, but I didn't have a signed copy. So he kept denying that anything was going on until one day, November of 2012, I actually received a photograph of the signature of the contract with the head of EDF, the head of Areva, and the head of the Chinese nuclear industry. Yeah. There were no politicians, which is extremely rare for a contract like that. So when I got the photo, I knew then it had been signed. And I went back. I saw myself and the select committee. We saw about 40 MPs. Certain of them wanted to set up an inquiry, parliamentary inquiry, and asked us if we could help them because they didn't know a lot about the nuclear industry. We said we could. And at one stage, we weren't getting anywhere. We didn't seem to be moving forward. So we had a lawyer for the European Works Council, and we went to see him and said, what can we do? And he said, we can bring a case against the CEO because he didn't inform you and consult you on the strategy of this Chinese contract. So a few days before the attack, we got all the Works Council together, about 25 people from the various countries. The lawyer was there. He explained the whole thing and said that we needed to vote if we wanted to send off a letter to the CEO saying we were taking him to court. So we voted unanimously on taking him to court. And I have a feeling that that might have been something that triggered something. And then at the weekend, I contacted two ministers. I was attacked on a Monday. On the Saturday, I contacted two ministers and said I needed to see them because I was being harassed at work. I had people shouting at me, telling me that I shouldn't be doing what I was doing.
The CEO threw a chair at you. I remember that.
No, that was exaggerated in the movie. Shouted at me, but he didn't actually quote.
What is undoubtedly clear is that a campaign of intimidation that started small, persevered, intensified. Even your own daughter believed that she was being followed.
Yeah.
But it comes to that morning, you're attacked in your home. And I realise, Maureen, to this day that it is, no doubt still difficult for you to talk about. But are you able to share a little bit of what happened to you on that day? Because you were censored in the most horrific way.
I was, yeah. Well, it was very early in the morning. My husband used to leave for work at about 6. And he called me at some stage and said to me, "You better hurry up." I had an appointment in the hospital for an MRI because I had fallen on my shoulder. And he said there was a lot of traffic. So the last thing I used to do before leaving the house in the morning was brush my teeth. And I was in the bathroom brushing my teeth and this black thing came down over my head. I felt what was a gun in my back. And then it's very hazy, very, very hazy. He brought me into the, it didn't happen downstairs in the basement. It happened in the room next to the bathroom. The knife was not stuck in a drawer, as is the case in the movie. And I thought he was going to kill me. I really, really thought I was going to die that day. And when you think you're facing death, there are no words to describe the terror that you're filled up with.
An A was cut into the skin of your stomach.
My tummy.
You were raped with an implement, namely a knife. And I should say that for anyone who needs to, rte.ie / helplines is available for anyone who needs it. But Maureen, I've covered many, many criminal law cases, and I have to find that the immediate aftermath as depicted in the movie, even with artistic license, was really difficult for me to watch. It was invasive interrogations, supervised toilet breaks, multiple gynecological exams, and a reenactment of a kind, although medical.
Well, all of that did happen. That's true. The reenactment, the gynecologists, it was just sheer horror.
And I know that
they never asked my permission. It was just kind of, excuse me, I'm going to be quite blunt, but it was kind of sit there, get up on the table, take off your clothes, spread your legs. And I was deconnected from my body because I couldn't stand what was happening to me.
You were traumatized.
Totally traumatized, totally. And that examination on the chair, I just couldn't get it. I didn't know what they were up to.
You were a victim in deep distress, but very soon the authorities begin to doubt you. They begin to doubt that you made this up, that you in fact tied yourself to that chair, that you put that implement, that knife inside of you. Do you think it was because you weren't regarded as a good victim, whatever a good victim is meant to look or sound like?
Yes, it's with time I realised that. In the very first examination, gynecological examination, the doctor said she's very distant. She's not very present. And he found that weird. He thought I should be crying, I should be screaming, I should be, and so on. And I was just numbed, totally, totally numbed. I didn't know any of these men. I had seen a psychiatrist on the very first night of the attack. He wrote down that he didn't see any sort of lying. He didn't see me making up anything, that my state, the state I was in, corresponded to what I was saying, and that I was deconnected from my body, which is a sign of trauma. But it wasn't taken into account.
There is a crime in the French criminal code of false denunciation or wasting police time. You were charged for that crime. You were put on trial.
That's right.
And you were found guilty. Why did you initially confess to doing so?
Because they threatened my family. after about 12, 13 hours, I can't remember, I was left on my own in the room. And this guy comes in and he says to me practically what was said in the movie, "I don't like people like you. Either you say that you made everything up, or we'll make sure, and the judicial system will make sure that neither you or your family will ever recover." And I immediately thought of my daughter and my granddaughter. And I said, I can't let anything happen to them. So I tried to invent a confession, and it actually didn't stand up, the confession, because it didn't make any sense. And the Attorney General came along to my confession. And that never happens in France. You never get the Attorney General coming in to listen to somebody's confession. Huh? And I would have said I was Jack the Ripper if it could have protected my family. And that's why I try to make up a confession.
Maureen, so few rapes are brought to conviction in Ireland, even fewer in France. I think we're less than 1% of rapes and attempted rapes result in conviction. But often the breakthrough for victim comes when someone somewhere says, "I believe you." And for you, that was it a military psychologist in the end?
A military psychiatrist, yeah, who was specialised in trauma. And I was scared initially going to see him. It was somebody who advised me. And literally after about 3 minutes, he asked me a couple of questions. And after about 3 minutes, he said, "Stop." He said, "I believe every word you say." And I looked at him and I said, "What? How?" And he says, "I know every single reaction that your body is having. I can see it." He said, "I can see it by your silences, that you're finding it very hard to talk about the whole thing." And from then onwards, we started working on getting me back. I often say he's the one who got me back. He was absolutely brilliant.
With those three
and
words.
I'll never be able to thank him enough. And he testified for me in the appeals court.
Again, Maureen, for many victims here and all around the world, the investigation and criminal law trial process can feel like a secondary attack, another assault.
Absolutely.
Another rape. And that's one of the reasons why we've such high attrition rates, why so many cases fall out. But again, the support was coming through for you, your psychiatrist.
Absolutely.
You have a new lawyer who found so many mistakes. You think, how could they have got a conviction in the first place?
But absolutely.
Your acquittal was obviously a cause for celebration and for your colleagues and your trade union colleagues who had supported you. Did it feel like one when you came out of that court in Versailles, an innocent woman?
Well, they don't give you the verdict immediately. I got the verdict 2 months later, and we were at home with my husband and friends here, and we were waiting for my lawyer to call me. And he called me and told me I was acquitted. So everybody started jumping for joy and saying, "This is great." And I just looked at them and I said, "I'm destroyed. I've been saying this for 6 years. And okay, I'm finally believed." And I said, "There's nothing for celebration there." But at least then I could start on the track to, you know, rebuilding myself completely. Psychologically, physically, because I wasn't sleeping, I wasn't eating. So from then onwards, I was able to start climbing back up the hill again.
You have,
and feeling better.
You know, I often think, had you pitched the facts of your story to a film company, that might have rejected it because it just
absolutely
seems so, you know, and this is your true story. You've dedicated your life to France. Do you trust French institutions now? Do you think it would have been any different had it been tried in Ireland, or do you think of that at all?
No, I don't think of that. No, I love French people. I got so much support. I literally had 400 employees wrote to me. Friends set up a committee, a support committee. Thousands of people signed that. So I have a great love and a great pride in French people, in their institutions. It's a disaster, total disaster. And people are aware of this.
Maureen, in movies, yes, we expect a resolution, maybe a Disney style, and they all lived, if not quite happily ever after, something comes to fruition. But, you know, the fact is that the deal that you agitated about did go ahead. The layoffs you feared did happen, and your attacker was never found. And I can understand why you didn't want to put yourself through a re-investigation process. Can I ask you, how do you learn to accept what happened to you? What keeps you going?
I worked on that a lot in therapy, on acceptance. And accepting something, it took me a long time to come to this conclusion, doesn't mean you agree with it. It just means I have no control over that. I don't agree, but I'll keep moving forward no matter what. And that's, I just had this, I don't know whether it's a force or strength, just to keep going forward. I also worked a lot on forgiveness, not because of what they did to me.
Do you forgive your attackers?
No, but I can live in peace. I don't want revenge. I'm no longer angry. I can live in peace, and that's that.
You've used your own experience remarkably to come forward and work with other women to speak up for,
yeah,
other women. When you look at the cost in pure financial terms, whatever about the emotional cost, but the cost of gender-based violence in the EU is a staggering $366 billion a year. The cost here,
yeah,
at home in Ireland,
yeah,
is $4 billion. You know, is it possible for victims to break through? Look, I mean, what is your message today to victims of gender-based violence?
It's to talk. Talk about it, to get into a group, an association, something where there are women who've had similar problems and realize you're not on your own. Talk, get it out of your system. And when you're in a group setting for women, you are believed. And that's very, very important. And I've seen some women really come through who haven't gone to trial either, because of a year or 2 years with us, we do various workshops and so on. And we've really discovered it's that we have to help them get it out and to believe them. You know, for the moment, I've given up on courts and things like that, because it can be a secondary victimization.
And yet, if victims stay the course, sometimes they can get a resolution. We can take on that impunity. Can I ask you, Maureen, just about your family and their experience of seeing the film? I haven't seen it myself last night. What was it like, well, for you, first of all, seeing it, but also just for your family, including your own family here in Ireland, who perhaps knew about what happened to you, but perhaps maybe couldn't maybe take on the scale of it until you see it on a big screen, subject, of course, to that artistic license that happens too.
Yeah, you're dead right. Yeah, my own family here in France, we went to see it last September in a private screening, and I had to walk out in the middle. I was just so shocked, because it's one thing to live something from the inside. You never project yourself outside of your body to see, you know, what other people can see. And I suddenly realized I knew my family, my son, my daughter, my husband, I knew that they were traumatized. But it suddenly hit me how traumatized they were too. And my family in Ireland, the movie was shown in March in Ireland. They thanked me for not telling them everything. I mean, they all came over to see me. They're back and forth over the years. They all supported me. But, I mean, there was no point in giving them horrific details with them being so far away. And they're very angry with France.
I'm sure they must be. I want to just ask you finally, Maureen, just before we let you go, you know, anyone listening might really, really be struck by the trauma and the just the incredulous nature of what you went through. But the film, and indeed your story in real life, it ends on a message of hope.
Absolutely. That's a message I'd like to give women or even whistleblowers. I mean, to keep on going, you can get through things. It can take years. There's no magic pill. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of self introspection. But you can come out the other side. You can find joy. You can have projects. You can move forward, I keep saying. So that's really the message, no matter how hard things are, to keep moving forward and never look back in anger. Because you only hurt yourself.
And when you look back, Maureen, do you think you would have done things any differently? You know, look, I mean, you were in such a prominent role. You were so devoted to your colleagues, to the workers who you represented, and, you know, protecting their interests. Looking back, do you think you would have done anything any different?
I would never have done it if I had known. You know, that's it.
It is an extraordinary story, Maureen Carney. It's wonderful the way Isabel Huppert says your name, pronounces your name in the movie.
Yeah.
It's very, it's very, very glamorous in it. But Maureen, a difficult story to share, but one I think that it's so important that it has been heard. And listen, we wish you and your family well, and in your work with all
Thank
of those
much.
Other women. We really appreciate you speaking to us, and just remind people, rte.ie/helplines, if you've been affected by any of the issues raised today. But for now, Maureen Carney, au revoir and thank you.
Merci beaucoup. Bonne journée. Au revoir.
Thank you. We'll take a quick break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.